Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. We're coming up to a very strange time of the year. We're coming up to the Christmas season. That might not be especially important for you or your culture or your religion, but it is a very strange time where our entire country has decided that we have 5 days to go and see some people if we want to. Anyway, I feel as confused and confused basically about pandemic life as I'm sure many of you do, and also if you have lost someone this year, or you know, you're just struggling with it from a grief point of view, it's really feeling like it's hard to grieve at the moment. Like there's not a lot of space for that because there's so much, the pandemic takes up so much of our thoughts. So just before Christmas we wanted to do a special episode with, you know her, you love her, she's a patron saint of the podcast. It is Saint Julia Samuel, everybody. She's been on the show before. She's just the most wisest person I know. And I just wanted to talk to her about more than I had done before, about grief, about grieving, about dealing with it, about coping. And as ever, I was just eternally grateful that she is in our lives and that we get to speak to her. I mention her book all the time, but she has written a book called Grief Works, and her new book just came out in paperback, which is called This Too Shall Pass, which obviously is perfect reading for a griefster. So I hope you enjoy. We refer to you all the time on the show, jokingly, as Saint Julia.
I promise you, that is so the reverse of the truth. And if my children heard, they would laugh from here to wherever.
I know, I think it's just nice to have, like, I feel like we all enjoy having like a group touchstone. So it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, Julia Samuel says, Julia Samuel. It's like, and lots of us have read your first book, Grief Works, and you have another one that's, well, came out this year called This Too Shall Pass, which is not as grief focused as Grief Works, but still obviously useful for someone navigating their way through it all.
It's about living losses.
Right.
So yes, it's about loss, but loss very much like with Corona, that is more invisible. Well, I mean, grief always is invisible, but it's living losses like divorce or losing your job or getting old or being menopausal or not having the life that you wanted. So kind of through every aspect of life, how we have to shed an old version of ourselves to come into the new present version of ourselves.
Yeah. So obviously still absolutely useful for anyone navigating their way through this process, because I've definitely learned as well that you can have your grief and then you'll still grieve other things, which can then bring up
your grief, you know, your loss of someone who's died, and then obviously if you move house or something happens, or big changes in your life can still take you back to that place.
Having babies, in your case.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, having babies, there's two case studies in my book about people becoming parents. One was a woman who came back to work, and the other was a man becoming a father. And it's an enormous loss. It's the sort of thing they wanted and they chose and kind of longed for, in both cases, actually, from lots of difficulty in infertility. And yet having a baby means the end to so much of your life that you took for granted before. And, of course, gives you great joy and great kind of meaning and love and pleasure. But it's a loss. And it would always, like with you, bring up the fact that your children aren't going to meet their granddad.
Yeah.
So it's a new experience, I think, whether it's a loss experience or a significant event in our lives, will always take us back to significant losses in our lives.
Yeah, do you think death has a... it's a stupid question, but like... I'm just wondering, like, if you haven't joined the club early or you haven't lost someone, what significant loss do you go back to? Do you think it's something particular of being in the grief club, so to speak, that when something else happens, you're taken back to that grief? Is it like grief is the ultimate loss and it will always trump everything? Or is that me talking as a big member of the grief club?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I mean... I think throughout our lives, whether we've had a significant loss, whether someone we really love has died, everybody will have experienced loss.
Yes.
So all of psychotherapy is about loss. Mm. It's about you haven't got the partner you wanted, you didn't have the life you expected to have, you're not the person you wished you were. But the thing about death is its irreversibility, and that you can point at it at a day and a time that person died. Whereas kind of life losses, living losses, are much more difficult to pin down. And they have a big effect on you, but they kind of can sneak up on you. So you can be 40. I've worked with many people who are 40 who kind of go, I slept through my 20s and mid-30s, and now I'm 40 and I haven't got the life that I expected to have. And it hits them as an enormous loss. But the build-up to it is very different to, say, the day your father died.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? That death, it's funny to give, like, a positive for death. Because normally you're like, well, we have it worse. But actually, you're right that it's... I've had friends before that have been, you know, down or, I suppose, almost on... You know, I can't diagnose them, but in depression... And they've said to me, oh, you know, I don't know why I'm depressed. It's not like I've gone through something like you've gone through. And you can see, not like an envy, but like it's my journey and my sadness is very clear. So like when I was in my 20s, I would see some people who were feeling kind of like, oh, who am I? What am I doing? And then they would almost feel guilty for those feelings. Whereas I had a very like, oh, my sadness is really wrapped in like my dad died. So I have a very clear point. This is what happened. This is the reason for lots of things. I can... pin it on that, as you said, that day, that moment. But I guess when you have that kind of amorphous sadness and you don't quite know why, I wonder if that it's not about harder, is it? But like, it's interesting to I don't know what that's like not to have something to be like, it's that I can point at it.
And I think obviously there isn't a hierarchy in these things, and you can't measure worse or better. But I mean, like in the era of the pandemic, it's ambivalent loss. You can't see it. And I think often the friends of yours, you know, they can't legitimize their loss. They can't say to themselves that what my feelings are valid. I'm allowed these feelings. And it might be leaving home and they're not ready to leave home at 25 because they're not as mature as some of the people who are older, but they feel really sad. Or, you know, there are so many multiple losses that we have through life, you know, endings and beginnings. And now in the time of corona, we have this permanent uncertainty that, I mean, life has always been uncertain. And those of us that have worked in death always know that any one of us can die at any point. So that it's a kind of false belief that we have control and we can plan for our future, because fundamentally, you know, life and death isn't in our gift. I mean, we influence it. But I think now everybody is feeling levels of loss, some much greater than others because they've actually lost their jobs or they can't pay their rent or, you know, they're very ill or they've had family members die. But other people have this kind of sense of disquiet and uncertainty and sort of greyness that is an ambiguous loss because of the lack of clarity. And I think they too, they can name it as corona, but don't really feel legitimate because they can see other people, you know, their fathers have died or they've lost their job. So it's a complex old business.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it, humans? I do feel, because I understand that, and I understand that, like, legitimising, I think, is such a shame that people judge their feelings. And obviously, I understand, I do it as well. But, like, you said that, like, oh, it's not valid. And there's often, I hear it so much of, like, oh, well, it's worse for others. Could have been worse, you know, so like, which I used to think was a very sort of noble attitude because I used to do that of like, well, my dad died at 15. He could have died when I was 2. So I'm lucky. Which actually I've learned through therapy that it's kind of just another way to hit yourself around the head because it's like, well, yes, you could have, it could have been worse. It could have been better. And actually what it is how it is and how you feel about it is okay. But it's so hard for us to allow ourselves, like you said, whether it's ambiguous loss, a living loss or a death loss, to allow ourselves to feel. I think we're so afraid to just allow feelings. Why is that, Julia?
Well, I think what's helpful is, in a way, is holding both.
Yes.
So that you hold both sides. You know, because in some ways when you denied, you know, it's lucky I wasn't 2, you're swiping the legitimacy or the importance of the death at 15. But actually, if you can acknowledge and express the sadness and the shock and the grief that is lifelong, at different levels of intensity, obviously more intense at the beginning, and hold that, and also seek on the other side of yourself, seek the light, seek to love again, to engage with life, to work, to have things that are meaningful and have children and move forward, and that you move between the two. I think we have this sort of very simplistic bi-directional kind of attitude that, you know, I'm either all sad or all happy. Yeah. And I think we need to allow ourselves, you know, like I say in Grief Works and in This Too Shall Pass, you know, pain is the agent of change. Mm. By supporting ourselves to experience and express the pain is how we heal in grief. And at the same time, not knocking that out, we need to choose to do things that support ourselves, that we connect to people that love us, that we do things that distract us. We listen to music, we dance, we give ourselves permission to have fun, even when we're grieving. And that gives us the resources and the robustness to go back and do that really shitty grief work that no one wants to do and no one wants to feel.
Yeah, I'm writing my book at the moment.
So good for you.
Thank you. Reading a lot about grief theory, and I've become a bit obsessed. I think I was getting there anyway with my own therapy, but I've become obsessed with this idea of two things existing at the same time.
The dual process, Strobe.
Dual process, yes. How do you say it? Strobe and Schutt?
Strobe and Schutt, I say. Strobe and Schutt. I mean, they're my favourite theorists of all of them.
Oh, I heart Strobe and Schutt. Like, I read it recently and I was like, and
that's
it. I mean, it's complicated, but like, to boil it down, as you said, it is oscillating between two things of like the grief work and when I say
restoration,
what I mean is like the days that you're just sobbing and snotting and you can't get out of bed, and the days where you just watch soap opera and you're scrolling on Instagram. And I speak to so many people who say, oh, I feel so bad because, you know, I'm just distracting myself, or I'm just getting on with life, and I haven't really felt sad. I'm obviously not doing it, inverted commas, properly, right, all this stuff. And now I feel so overjoyed that I can say, you're doing it right. Like, that's what you're meant to do. You're meant to give yourself a break so that you can go back to those days. But I only found, you know, really looked at this theory properly recently, and I was like, for someone to sort of put it so clearly of like, no, have a day where you watch Netflix, then have a day where you're crying. And obviously you can't schedule it, but
I think doing it mindfully helps. So not having that shitty committee where you turn on yourself like, I'm not doing it right, but kind of knowing today is the day I'm really going to cry and I'm going to call up my friend and she's going to come and sit with me and maybe she'll take me for a walk or whatever that is.
Mm.
And on the other day, I'm going to do something fun. I'm going to, in the old days, go to a movie. Or see friends or listen to music and dance or Netflix and scroll. But doing it knowing that I'm doing it to give myself a break from the pain.
Yes, yes.
And that the movement between the two is what shifts your psychological, the work of it is to face the reality of the loss, to let yourself know in a way that you can't not know that the person has died.
Mm.
And the thing that matters most, and I think now in the time of Corona, and it's very paradoxically difficult because of social distancing, is our relationship with ourselves, that we support ourselves and compassionate to ourselves, but also the love and connection to other people. So that is the predictor of all outcomes of every aspect of our life, whether it's a living loss or a death, is the importance of relationship, the importance of love. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and maybe this is in kind of current language to gender specific, but what Strobinshute talked about is that women tend to be loss-oriented and men tend to be restoration-oriented. So women tend to emote and feel and go on that Sherlock Holmes mission to find out everything that happened and have the memory box and hold on to touchstones and kind of hold on to their pain. Men tend to be restorative, that they want to have a plan, they want to have hope for the future, they tend to go back to work earlier. If they have a child die, they tend to want to have another child sooner. And so with couples, I kind of tell them about that model, and so that he can help her be more restorative and she can help him have an opportunity to express his grief. And so that rather than thinking, him thinking she's a wet rag that never stops crying and she thinking he's a tough bastard that doesn't care, they kind of understand that that is their kind of physiological wired tendency. And the last bit of it is that children very naturally hop between the two. Children very naturally feel very sad. It's like jumping in a puddle. And very naturally jump out of a puddle, kick a ball, play with a friend, eat an ice cream, yelp with laughter. But when they're in the puddle, what we often do as parents is want to protect them from their pain and say, no, don't cry, it's all right. And actually, we just need to be able to let them cry, be sad, comfort them, let them be and do what they do. And they will very naturally hop out of the puddle and be a happy kid.
So interesting, isn't it? I think, I'd forgotten that bit in Strobinshute, that, and obviously, as you said, the language perhaps is constrained for what now, how we think and talk of gender, so that is to be aware, or even a heteronormative idea of relationships, but it's equally doesn't stop it being an interesting point of view about how people typically react.
It's a tendency.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I also think it's so interesting that what you're saying about the child, let them be sad, let them be in the puddle, but that's also what we don't do to ourselves, which is why you don't do it to children, because you're like, I can't do this, therefore you shouldn't do this. It's actually, like you said, if you can let a child be sad. And I've been obviously I'm like, you know, parenting a toddler, so I'm reading a lot of stuff about this and letting a child just cry without being like, it's fine, it's all right, it's all right. And then when you don't do it, you realize how much you silence people when they're sad, you know, like the, oh, it's okay, I'm here, all the talking rather than just silence while someone cries. Like that's okay. We're so afraid of that, aren't we? We're so afraid of it. And a child expressing that makes us, I think, very aware of how we don't express our own sadness. So when a child is just like, I'm sad, you're like, oh God, that's what I don't do. Why don't I do
but
that?
But also I think our feelings are transmitted bodily, particularly between mother and child or father and child. And so seeing your 2-year-old or 3-year-old or 15-year-old daughter suffering as a parent triggers a lot of disturbance in you.
Yes.
And it can feel unbearable, you know. And we're wired to do that, aren't we, to protect them in order so that they grow and thrive, so that we do protect them. And so it sends off all those signals in us, like, help, got to make it stop. And in a way, what you're saying is that we need to do the same. I mean, as adults, we are much more like children. So that we need to give ourselves permission to be sad and allow ourselves to express it. And we need to kind of allow our children to be sad or have the feelings that they have without trying to interrupt them and block them because we find them unbearable to be beside.
Yeah, and I think that image of them being in a puddle is so nice because it's actually something, I suppose it makes me think of like Winnie the Pooh or something, but there's like a puddle is...
It's not permanent.
It's not permanent. Yeah, it's not endless. It's not deep. Like you sit in a puddle, you're really muddy, and then you can get out and wash your mud off your wellies, you know, which I do a lot of at the moment. And there's something very like, yeah, not, I don't know, odd, I guess, but sweet about that of like, yeah, you sometimes are in a puddle. That's life, isn't it? And it's okay to sort of be there for a bit and then come out again. But that's what I think is the, for me anyway, was the key to grief is knowing that you can get out. Because I think there's so much fear around feelings with grief of like, if I get in that puddle, it's going to turn into a well and I'm stuck.
It's going to be a hole. I'm never coming out. And I think Martin Seligman, who's an American, he's basically a sort of happiness therapist, and I hate the idea of that, but psychologist. And he talks about the three Ps. I'm sure in your research you've done the three Ps.
Oh,
personalization.
Oh, yes, go on.
Pervasiveness and permanence. Okay. So that with grief, it's personalization. It's against me. It's about me. It's negative to me. It's my fault. I'm bad. I deserve this. This is my punishment. And there are many colours of that we can make it personal. Pervasive is that it's going into every area of our lives. So in a way, looking at that restoration loss model, it's like you stay in the loss model. You stay in the well. You choose to stay in the well. You don't give yourself permission to be restorative and permanent. Like, I am never going to get over this. And I know that feeling just, you know, every day that when you wake up in a bad mood or it's raining, you think it's never going to stop raining. And then the sun comes, it's like, oh, I didn't expect that. Or I didn't expect to laugh at something and feel in a different... I mean, I think that is... You know, as human beings, we have a negative bias to primitively from when we were on the sort of savannah millions of years ago. So we look to the negative and we haven't kind of updated our physiognomy or our understanding of ourselves to know that we move and that we oscillate. And we need to... We can take responsibility for lots of things that influence how we do that. I think one of the complexities, and I think this is true for living losses as well as death, is that when somebody dies, particularly in the first months and maybe years, we kind of feel we owe them a duty to suffer.
To like mourn for them,
I'm imagining you looking at me wherever I believe you to be in my belief system, whether it's in my heart or in heaven, or and I need to show you and honour the level of the loss. And if I let myself have joy or pleasure or laugh, I'm in some way denying the intensity of how much I feel about you. And again, it's the same permanence, unitary kind of thing. And so I work a lot with people about allowing both again, like giving themselves permission to really honour the loss and not fast track it and not get over it and give themselves the space and the time to honour the level of the loss and how that will always be with them. And at the same time, let themselves have pleasure and joy and hope and connection and live the life, live their lives.
It's funny, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because we are such, our brains love binary, our brains love it so much. And maybe that's like, you know, why you can look at the success of computers for us. Like, we love it. We're like, it is raining, it will forever rain, I am sad, this is how I feel. And I think especially, I don't know, maybe it's my generation, like obsessed with like, this is who I am, this is who I am. Like, you can look at my Instagram, you can read my tweets, you can see what I'm wearing and it proves who I am. Well, it's actually like, this, which is why I guess when grief comes into your life, you're like, oh my God, who am
I? Chaotic.
I'm chaotic. I'm everything. Whereas as you said, like if you work in the death industry, before Corona, we knew that people just drop dead and that's scary. And it's like, holding two things seems to be very difficult for humans. Like, you can be in grief, you can honor them, you can miss them so much, but you can laugh at a film, you can have friends around. And, you know, I've heard people...
You can have sex.
You can have sex, yes. You can be...
You
do
can have
joyous
orgasms.
Moments.
You can have amazing experiences.
Yeah.
And it isn't denying it.
Yeah. And that guilt we have of, I think, you know, it's a bit of a Victorian hangover of, like, there's an appropriate way to mourn someone, and it is being sad for at least a year, not walking. Because I know, I've heard so many stories or, like, you know... my mum's friends of someone's husband dying or something, and being like, oh, someone's over it quick, you know, I saw her out at the shops, and oh, you know, she's got a new boyfriend. It's like, yeah. And when I had the wonderful Simon Thomas on, whose wife died very tragically, very quickly, and you know, he spoke about it very eloquently, and it's one of the few episodes I had where when I tweeted about it, some people were like, well, he's with someone already, he's with a new person. And I was like, oh my, like, I mean, yeah.
Whoa.
Well, I mean, unpack the audacity of your opinion on anyone else's life. But we find it so hard that we, like you said, that you can be grieving and happy. You can be happy and sad. Like, these things exist together. The sun does come out after the rain. Like, puddles don't stay there forever. And there's these myriad of examples that tell us constantly this will happen. But when we're in those feelings, I know when I'm having a bad time, when I'm in the midst of a wave, I've got better, but it's taken years to go, Carad, this isn't going to last. Like, this feeling isn't going to last when I'm really in the pit of, like, oh my God, everything's awful. And it's so, even though you know, like you said, you have all this life experience, this won't last, this feeling won't last. The fear that it might, that this might be the one that stays forever, is still strong for us, yeah.
And I think one of the things I think about and to some extent worry about is that it's an amazing thing that young people, millennials and Generation Z, are much more emotionally intelligent and much more emotionally honest and expressive. But I think, to link to what you're saying, like allowing feelings, I think there can be a pathologizing of feelings. Like, I have anxiety disorder. Mm. I'm depressed. I have, you know, they can give themselves a DSM-4 diagnosis, yeah, when actually it's just feelings.
Yeah.
And that links to your permanence of them. So if you give yourself a diagnosis, like, I have anxiety disorder, rather than, I've had a few months where I felt really scared and really worried about not getting a job or losing my job, and I need to do the physiological things that help me, that I exercise, that I eat well, that I have fun with friends, that I do some kind of breathing thing. But giving yourself a diagnosis is very limiting.
Mm.
It puts you in the box, in that fixed box, that this is who I am. And then if I start an Instagram feed of anxiety disorder kid, yep, or whatever it is,
yeah,
then it's self-fulfilling, and you become this person that maybe you were just a bit scared. I'm not denying that there are people who have real,
yes,
diagnosis.
But
I see more and more people giving themselves self-diagnosing, and that worries me.
I think that's so interesting, Julia. I think it's really interesting. I'm obsessed with, like, what generations can teach each other, because I think whenever something new comes along, we're so good at sweeping everything away. And I think you're right. You know, I'm the edge of a millennial, so I'm like, I just scrape in as a millennial, apparently. But I think it's very interesting that this definition that, like you said, so this generation I've never heard so many mental health conversations, you know, and as someone, I do suffer from anxiety. It wasn't something that was ever discussed when I was a teenager.
Fantastic.
I didn't know what it was until I went to therapy, and then now I see people talking about it, and I feel very like, oh, great, you know, it's a thing that I have.
It's normalised.
Yeah, it's normalised. It's really nice to not feel, as I used to feel, like, oh, I'm a really just weird, crazy person that obsessively thinks
I'm the weirdo and everyone else is happy.
Yeah. So I think, it's like you said, it's so wonderful that they have this, but, you know, the same with grief. There's a lot of grief accounts now on Instagram that there definitely wasn't when Griefcast started. And like you said, there's a lot of, you know, very specific niche mental health things. And that is not to deny that those people have those things, of course. But I think it's really allowing yourself to grow and change. is really
And that's
important.
What my book's about.
Yes.
So the whole kind of thesis of this Two Shall Pass is that we are wired to change, that we do change, but change is an active process, and that we have to allow ourselves to go through that process of change and not block it. Because the research is irrefutable. Those that block and deny change have less joy and less success in life. And when change comes around again, it hits them harder. Whereas those that allow the push and pull between the past and the future in all these iterations, like how you feel about yourself, what you're doing in your life, where you are in your life, where you're heading in your life, and that there is a sort of fertile void where you can not know where you're going or who you are, which is the space between a sort of ending and a new beginning. Those that support themselves to do that and sort of shed their skin thrive. I mean, it's irrefutably sort of researched on in every kind of level. So in a way, what you're saying and what I'm thinking about is, if you give yourself labels that fix you, then it's very difficult to grow and thrive and adapt through life.
And I think especially that really makes me think of grief. Because if you hold, and I had this for years, if you hold on to your grief at one point in time and you're like, you know, I think the first time you get your head around your grief is an important moment. The first time you're like, oh, okay, I'm not wailing. I'm not, you know, I'm not distracting myself.
I'm not making a fuss.
Yeah, I'm kind of, there it is. There's my grief. I understand now. This is who I'm carrying around. And that first moment can really stay with you for a long time. And you can think, I've got it. I understand my grief. It's this. And I did this, definitely. And then you don't allow your grief to change. You don't allow yourself to change, your grief to move with you, and to look at it someday and go, oh, I don't feel like that anymore. I don't feel like that about my dad. That particular thing doesn't make me cry anymore. And I think...
You can release yourself.
Yeah, and I think that's such a helpful part of the journey. But equally, allowing your grief to change, it reminds me of what we're saying about feeling guilty of not honouring them. That you feel guilty of like, oh, I don't feel as bad as I did. I feel different. Yeah. I feel sad. But I don't feel like, oh, I can't get up and I will cry if I start talking about it. I feel like I can talk about it, or my friends can tell me about their Father's Day and I'm not like punching the wall. And then you feel like, oh, ugh, like, is that bad? And if you're going to grieve for a long time, you know, I'm someone who's 20 plus years in the process. You're going to have to let your grief change. But that is hard, isn't it? It's hard to allow yourself that.
I mean, I think there's two things. I think one is to acknowledge that you're not blooming in charge of it. So,
amen to that, Julie. Yeah, yeah.
So with all our technology and 21st century kind of science and brilliance, we are still human beings that we're not in charge of ourselves. When we can't Marie Kondo our feelings into color-coded drawers of
I
of
wish
pink.
We could one day.
I wish we could, but maybe we couldn't, because then we'd be robots.
Yeah, exactly.
And that isn't where the joy is. And the other thing, you know, I think the word that is most useful about grief and for living losses is accommodation, is that, you know, if I could show listeners, is that at the beginning, when someone dies or you have a huge loss, your husband leaves you, your wife leaves you, it feels like it's all there is. It tears a hole in you that you feel that there's nothing else. You're just a husk. You're just this hole. And then over time, as you go through that process of moving between your loss and being okay and being restorative, you adapt. And actually that hole may stay the same, the same size. It will always be big, and the shape of the person that's left you or what's happened to you or the person that's died. But you build your life around it so that you build on top of it, so that you accommodate it. So there may be a time 25 years later where you're thinking about your dad as you see your child go to university or do something significant. And there'll be an intensity of it that feels like the day he died. I mean, for less long, but piercing intensity. And then other times you won't even think about him. He'll be at the back of your mind. You'll be getting on. You'll be busy. You'll be having fun. And that, again, you move in and out of that. So, but it doesn't deny the significance or the enormity of what's happened.
Yeah.
And I think, again, in our kind of technological world, we want to you know, people talk about closure or ending, or that you fix something. And these things, they're not fixing, they are finding a way of living with and learning to live with and learning to thrive with pain. Mm. So again, this idea of pathologizing feelings is, it's like they're bad, but they're not bad.
They're just,
you know,
feelings.
Feeling sad is not bad. Mm. I mean, we don't like it. I don't actually mind feeling sad. I hate feeling really furious with someone that I want to kill them.
Yeah.
It's the worst. And it's because you don't know what to do with it because you can't actually kill them.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I hate those feelings most because they just go round and round.
I know.
And I want to be able to shut them down and Marie Kondo them into the sort of depths of, make them go away.
But then you do get the joy when that feeling goes. Because I hate feeling when I've had a row with someone. And you can't, you're both at the point where you can't actually speak yet. You both need to calm down. But then when you do, it's like, oh, that feeling's gone. Hooray, hooray, hooray. Yeah. Like, we're okay. They're not crossing me. I'm not crossing them. Oh, God. Yeah. Thank God.
I like them again. Yeah. And you feel most angry with the people that you love most.
Yes,
people you don't really care about. You don't give a shit.
No, you're just like, all right.
But, you know, when I really hate my husband and think I cannot even look at you for 1 second, that's quite scary.
I know, you're so furious.
That would really turn my life upside down 40 years later.
But it's okay to feel that, guys. It's okay if you can't bear to look at them for 1 second. St. Julia even feels that. So it's all right. It's human.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Yeah, God, it's so interesting, isn't it? It's just this idea, like you said, of, I think the fixable thing, again, is a lesson, a hard lesson I've learned on the way, that it's not about fixing. It's about, like you said, accommodating. And I think that's, you know, it's like ball in the box theory, isn't it? Or fried egg theory. That and there's some really good visualizations online if you Google and want to see, because I think the visualization really helps, doesn't it? When you see the square getting bigger,
really helps,
around the pain.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw that, I was blown away. I was like, oh, yeah, that's what grief feels like. I see someone's drawn it. Like, oh, amazing. Because it was like, yes, the idea that it doesn't go away makes people think, oh, right, so you spend the rest of your life in
miserable,
black, weeping at a graveside.
Queen Victoria.
Yes. Yeah. And then you're like, no, it doesn't go away, but I am happy, I have good days, but it's just there. And I always... which maybe is unhelpful, but I always sort of refer it like to having children or having family. Like, you don't just stop talking about an aunt or a son because it's been 5 years. Like, if you brought up someone in your family, like, oh, you know, my uncle has written a book, you'd be like, why are you telling me? He's been your uncle for 20 years, stop talking about him. But when someone's dead, we are like, oh, you're still talking about it? Like, kind of, why? But it's because they were important, they mattered. And even if you had a difficult relationship with them, they were part of who you are. So I think we...
And even when they die, the relationship never dies.
Oh, yes.
So you love them, and you may even hate them in death. I mean, I think you can have you can hate your parent for dying, and
oh God, yes,
then feel nothing at all because you aren't allowed to feel hate, but you can be so furious with them. That kind of fierce love, like, how could you leave me?
Yeah.
You know, which you're not allowed to feel. It's not kind of okay. Like hating your children, you're not allowed to hate your children. And of course, we all hate our children. And boy, do they hate us.
Yeah. Exactly. And that allowing those difficult feelings that we don't, the society sort of, somewhere in your head, I don't know where you get taught this, yeah, that it's wrong. Where does it happen? Where do we get the message or the memo, like the email that's like, by the way, these feelings are not acceptable?
I think a lot of it's movies now.
Oh, really?
I think, how often do you see a movie that you think is like real life?
Yeah, especially, you know, when it comes to grief, very rarely.
But particularly when it comes to grief, but also love. It's like you fall in love, you smooch, you have unbelievable sex, and then you live happily ever after, having had lots of difficulties on the road, and then you find each other, and then you're all sorted. And that is just the blooming beginning, you know.
I talked about this to Catherine Mannix, because she was...
she's great.
She's amazing, and she wrote a wonderful book with the end in mind about death. And she was talking about, as obviously someone who works in palliative care, how frustrating hospital dramas are, like how the lie that they perpetuate. And I brought up to her as a
I love hospital dramas, by the way. Having worked in a hospital for 25 years, I love them.
Well, she was complaining about, you know, when someone dies, the way they treat it is very, again, like, oh, there's all this trouble, they have a moment, it's all right, they die. And I was saying, when I don't have my grief hat on, when I have my writer hat on, often death is used to make it another point. And the same as you're saying with romance, like romance films are designed, like that movie is designed to give you the arc very neatly and tie it up at the end. And if they hadn't lived happily ever after, you'd leave the cinema a bit uncomfortable, because the nature of stories is they must end. And as humans, we really need the end. And I think that's the trouble, is like you said, we get mixed up between satisfying narratives and life. Like, a film is not life. A film is a satisfying narrative. If I tell you a joke, you don't want me to just walk off before I finish it. You want the end. But you wouldn't then go, oh, all things should repeat this pattern. But like I said, we like binary, we like patterns. So I think you're right. We see this idea of death in films or love in films, and it's appealing, because it's like, everything was tied up. That they were sad about the death, but then they felt better. Hooray! And we want that.
But it educates us then to believe that that's what life should be like,
yeah,
or is like.
Rather than, I think, and if we all understood narrative more, you'd be like, the writers wrote a narrative to make me feel better walking out of a cinema. They did not write a narrative to make me feel better about my life. They wanted the hour and a half to be satisfying. Like a meal. It's
drama.
Like, yeah, I've given you the meal, I've served it to you, here's the pudding, here's the coffee, well done. Whereas, like, if I was like, oh, you're not having pudding, now you're having a bowl of cereal, and, oh, yeah, there's no tea, you now have to have a boiled egg after you've eaten the spaghetti bolognese, you'd be like, oh, this is awful. But that's life, guys.
I think that restaurant metaphor is perfect. Like, you go to a restaurant, you can order it off the menu, get what you want, it's all there for you, and it's, you know, depending on whether you've gone to a pizzeria or a posh restaurant, you kind of get what you expect. But it's finished, and it's a deal. Or a kind of posh restaurant if you're celebrating, and you can order what you want off the menu, you know the deal, you pay for it, and hopefully most of the time you get what you want. And life, I think we sign up, we know that we need connection, that we know that we need relationships, and we know that they're complicated. We sort of say it kind of quite often about, you know, love is tricky, da-da-da-da. But when it comes to living it, somehow we think we're failing when you know, like the pictures of parenthood. The pictures of parenthood are all pink and fluffy or blue and fluffy, and parenthood is amazing and incredibly hard and boring and thrilling, and the same as relationships, are all of those things. But they're messy and chaotic, and they don't have clean lines and beginnings and endings. And they're very sort of crucial to our health. I mean, we know that those that have sound, reliable relationships do much better in life than anybody else. They're wealthier, they're healthier, their memories are better in old age, they have less pain in old age, they're more successful. And so the predictor of our outcome is our relationships.
And that's not just love relationships, right? You mean just like any solid relationship?
Connection.
Yeah, connection.
Solid, reliable, good relationships that you feel close to people.
Yeah.
And we're physically, you know, again, from sort of evolutionary science, we are wired to connect to other people.
Mm.
And when we don't, you know, loneliness is like smoking for our health. It's as bad for us as smoking a lot, 30 cigarettes a day. So relationships really matter. And it means that we need to navigate or know how to navigate that they're tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what you said is so true. Like, and when they go wrong, you haven't failed. It's just gone wrong.
No.
That's what relationships do. And the same with, it reminds me of, I can't remember who I spoke to about talking about illness, of like when the body goes wrong, that's sometimes what the body does. It's not, you haven't done this to yourself. Yeah, obviously in other circumstances, perhaps you have, but you know, that's what bodies do. They sometimes stop working. Relationships sometimes stop working. That's the randomness and nature of life. But we as humans seem to react like, oh, I should have been the engineer of this situation. I should have engineered this relationship better. I should have cooked it better. I should have paid more attention to it. And actually, yeah, it's messy and chaotic. And that's,
I think that's really true. And also, I think in relationships as opposed to our health, I mean, both we influence from our behaviours is, again, from films and books, this idea of the one, that we find our soulmate and they make us happy forever after, isn't the reality of the research. The research is that for relationships, for love relationships, that the outcome is those that commit and negotiate and find a way of living together, that they adapt with each other, for each other. Yes. And it's not like this perfect, like, looking at you just brings me joy. It's like when you, you know, you work out who takes out the bins.
Yeah,
you work out what annoys you about each other. You find a way of living with the stuff that really pisses you off because the good stuff is worth it. So it's not, you know, I think we have this, again, this binary thing about love, that it's perfection or nothing, or my soulmate or nothing. And so with relationships, it's very much about working with it. And the best guy talking about relationships is Gottman. Do you know?
No. Oh, yes. Yes, I do know. Yeah.
And his research is, you know, he can tell by looking in a couple of minutes of how people are together.
Wow.
Through the way they kind of look at each other with kindness, little contact points, where they listen to each other, those kinds of things, behaviours.
Well, I think lockdown was very interesting for that sort of thing. And the biggest conversation I had with people who are in a relationship, and obviously if you're not, it does, you know, it's not, you were in relationship with everybody, we all are, wherever you were on lockdown. And the biggest conversation that seemed to be happening was like working out a good cooking and cleaning rota that made both people happy. And if you can find that, and it wasn't necessarily...
And parenting and working.
Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily like equal or like this person does it. It was just like things that work for you that you're like, actually, I never want to do that, but you're happy to do that and I will do this thing that you never do. That's what I've been surprised with. A marriage is like, you're like, oh, I thought we'd split it down the middle and everything. You're like, no, we had the best conversation. We finally admitted that, like, I'm terrible at stacking the dishwasher, but I'm really good at the engineering part of it. No, of like putting it on and making sure the salt and the rinse aid. And he was like, I don't understand how it works. I don't understand what this is. And I was like, will you stack it forever and I will always put it on? And he was like, yes. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad we reached this conclusion rather than both being like, oh, she's done that wrong again. And I mean, we should talk about, obviously, lockdown and corona. And this is such uncertain times that we're living in. I mean, as you said, if you work with death, you've always known we live in uncertain times. But these are particularly uncertain times because all of our key, you know, being able to get the tube, go to the cinema, see friends, are suddenly vulnerable and shaky. I mean...
And our sense of our immortality.
Yes.
So most of us live in blissful ignorance that, you know, death happens to other people at some point over there that I'm not going to think about can or may happen to me or people I love. And I think corona has forced everybody to look at their mum and dad if they're younger, or their mum and dad if they're the older ones, to kind of look at their immortality and face it in a way that no generation has, I think, since the Second World War.
We talked about World War II and how it affected everyone, and I've been thinking that a lot, that this obviously it's different, and this is not a war of a physical war of people leaving, but that level of grief, it's probably the last time that our country had to face this level of grief of everybody being touched by it.
And the world stopped.
Yeah.
The whole world had a version of it for themselves, yeah. Worse and better, depending where you were and what country you're in. And that kind of the global impact of it, that everybody is affected at greater or lesser levels, is like a war in a sense. And I think it is shifting and changing everybody's relationship about everything. About what matters to me,
yes.
What's who I care about, what work is like, what I believe in, about health, about your immunity, about science, about connection. I don't think there's an aspect of any one of our lives that Corona hasn't in some way shaken up.
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of grief. We talked about this on the Twitter a lot, the griefsters, of like, when you lose someone pre-Corona, you want the world to stop. You feel like, how is everyone...
You want the clocks to stop.
Yeah, how is everyone going about their jobs and enjoying themselves? And it happened. It felt like, to me, like the world was doing kind of what I'd always imagined it should do when someone died. And it was doing it, and it was horrible. Because I was like, yeah. It made me realise, for me, obviously it's very personal, when I wanted the world to stop, I wished that everyone had understood how I felt. And actually, it made me realise that when the world doesn't stop, when you're grieving, it's really useful, because it reminds you of the restorative. It reminds you life goes on. It shows you people having good times. And when you're grieving, you think, oh, fuck you, drinking and going to the cinema and having a nice time. But actually, it's really useful to see the river still flowing. And I think it's so interesting, Corona, we didn't have that. We didn't have, oh, the world's still going on over there. It was gone.
I think that's really right. And I think the thing about uncertainty, you know, hope is the alchemy that turns a life around. Mm. And in a way, what you're talking about, when the clocks don't stop, it gives you hope that you can live again and love again and get back into the flow of life. And with Corona, none of us quite know how we will get back into the flow of life, and it's hard to have hope, but we need to have hope, even if it's a glimmer that's miles away. We have to, you know, hope isn't just a feeling, it's a cognitive thought with a kind of plan and a place to aim for. So I think each of us needs to kind of create a spark of hope in our own lives of what that might be for us, because it's a bit like when you're talking about loss, orientation and restoration. If you hold on to the not knowing and the bleakness and the tunnel, then that's again self-fulfilling. So you need to choose to look for the light and look for hope. Allow yourself to feel the loss of not knowing and what this has meant to us. And also take the teachings from it. Like, learn from it. You know, that we humans have made ourselves the most important species and trash the planet, but we need the planet, you know, and Corona's taught us something about that. Watching spring while the world stopped, that the spring blew our minds, you know, when there was no aeroplanes and no cars, and we could hear the birds and see the blossom, and then through the summer as well, so that we kind of, I think, breathed in and embodied the seasons in a way that we haven't before. I think we appreciated supply food chains in a way that we haven't before. We just take for granted, you just press an app and you get your, you know, Sainsbury's, Tesco drop off, and now you have to kind of think about it and plan food. And so I think there's a part of it that we give ourselves the humility as human beings that we aren't the be all and end all, that we have to think about other people and connect to other people. We have to think about our relationship with the planet and our environment, our neighbourhood, our community, and that speed isn't getting masses done and being your diary kind of ruling your life. Speed isn't the answer. I mean, one of the things I think a lot of people got from Corona was recognizing that slow is a meaningful way of living. There's a great African proverb which says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
Yeah.
Again, it's trying to hold two things of, like, obviously what's happened is terrible and tragic, and the loss of jobs and, you know, the recession we're hitting,
life,
of course. But at the same time, it benefited us all in a very strange way, in that none of us could have ever have stayed at home and stopped and breathed in the way that we were forced to. And for some people that was deeply painful, and for other people it was wonderful. I know people who were like, yeah, I've had a lovely time. And those two things can exist. And I think perhaps we should, you know, we always say there's no grief hierarchy. Perhaps there needs to be no corona hierarchy, unless, like, exactly, you literally lost someone and they died, then you can have some hierarchy. But, like, of being like, it's just a thing that happened, and how you feel about it is okay. Like, there were positives in there. And I'm obsessed with this. There's positives and negatives to every single thing that happened.
Nothing
is either all good or all bad. And I think you're right. The slowing down. And it's funny. I actually interviewed comedian Jess Robinson, who lost her dad during the period, coronavirus. And she was saying that it was amazing. She was like, obviously she was so sad that her dad died, but she had all this time to think, to grieve. She wasn't rushed back to work. And I found that really interesting, because I was expecting her to say, oh, it's so awful and we couldn't see people. And she was like, it was wonderful. You know, people didn't come round and we just took time. I do think, it's, in terms of grief, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's that thing, like, of being afraid to feel. If you can, as you said, make a hope for it. I've never thought about it like that, Julia. I really like that it's not just a feeling, it's a cognitive thought, and therefore you have a responsibility to think it. Like, to be like,
and plan.
Yeah, and plan, like, how can I plan some hope? Because I get very scared of hope as a, you know, full on death anxiety.
Then the gods are going to come down and
the fates,
if God sees you hoping,
yes,
they are going to absolutely knock you out.
They're like, there she is, all joyful. Come on, lads, let's take this away. Yeah.
Can I say one more thing about grief in corona, not denying Jess's experience, is that for other people, because they couldn't be with the person when they were dying.
Yeah, she was able to be with her dad, so that was very...
And many people were. Mm. They could let, you know, one family member or two family members, but lots of hospitals and care homes didn't let any visitors at all. And so, you know, the speed of the diagnosis, that someone who was perfectly healthy, he may have had diabetes or other comorbidities, but actually was living a perfectly healthy life, working or getting on with their life, was suddenly ill, and then suddenly became super ill and is ambulanced to hospital. And then you have all the space where you have no contact with the hospital because you couldn't go in. So all that kind of craziness of not knowing, is he in intensive care? Is he coming out of intensive care? Ringing the hospital relentlessly and sometimes getting someone who can give you information, sometimes not. And then if they do die, sometimes seeing that on a screen, so that it's through a tablet, an iPad or a phone. And the surrealness of that, not seeing the body, not having the proper opportunity to say goodbye, to hold their hand, to love them, to do the things that really make an enormous difference. You know, in both my books, I talk about, it's the regrets that derail your grieving process, the things that you didn't do, the opportunities you didn't have, the conversations you didn't have. And then these sometimes Zoom funerals, or certainly only 5 or 10 people socially distanced funerals, so that there may be thousands of people now. You know, there are normally 8 significant people in every death, so I can't do the math, but that's a lot of people. A lot of them feel like it's surreal. Like, I know that he died, she died, but I didn't have those. So the reality, facing the reality of the death, is how you grieve. Is how you need the reality, you need the data of those memories of touch, feel, sight, sound, smell. And you don't have those. So a lot of them feel that their grief is suspended.
You're right to talk about it, because obviously what happened with Jess is still deeply sad, but there was, like you said, a range of experiences. And I definitely found that some of the hardest bits of lockdown was hearing people on the radio talking about not being able to be there. And if you are in the club and you know what it feels like to be there and how hard that is. But if someone had said to you, you can't come in this room, you would have ripped that door down, because you were like, but to be in a situation when you can't rip a door down because it's dangerous to other people, it's dangerous to you, it's dangerous to your, you know, other loved ones. My heart broke when I was hearing them just say, you know, I found out, oh, they couldn't even get the FaceTime, or I was FaceTime. I just thought, oh my. And a lot of the tweets were about that, of people who were in the club already just going, oh my God, like, I know how hard this is.
This is crazy.
This is worse. And it's funny, isn't it? Because we say there's no grief hierarchy, but I really did feel like, oh wow, this is death in the time of Corona. Like, that, however tragic your story is, if you could be there, if you had that option to be there, and it wasn't dangerous to you or your other loved families to be with someone, it's just, yeah, I someone described it as just trauma on top of trauma.
And it is traumatic.
That's what I've really stayed with me, of like, not only have you got the grief, as you said, but then it's surreal and...
It's traumatic grief. And traumatic is, you know, the way I term traumatic grief is like normal grief with a volume turned up.
Oh, gosh.
So all the normal feelings that you have of sadness, fury, fear, chaos, messiness, numbness, all of that is like in fourth gear.
Mm.
And that is really very overwhelming. And I would imagine, and I would encourage people, if they can, and as much as they can, to get therapy, to get trauma therapy. EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, is the most kind of effective for that, because I don't think they can do it on their own.
No, and there's going to be a lot, as you said, that's really interesting, that eight significant people in every death, there's going to be a lot of people having to, it's a shit thing to say, I can't imagine, but I just can't, because I can't get my head around having to grieve someone in this way, but also the pandemic's still going on. So it's not like you can be like, well, that's done.
It's finished. Close that door, look forward.
I now can hug these people and have a memorial. I mean, I've had several deaths in this time. Not extremely close, but, you know, some more painful than others. And there's been some funerals, some Zoom funerals, and then, postponed because we're going to do memorial service. Memorial. And you're like, still waiting for...
When?
Yeah, for somebody... And sometimes it's just, yeah, like, my great aunt died, who, you know, was very elderly, was in a home, but was such, like, a larger-than-life figure, real, like, East End gal, like, just... And she had to have this very small funeral, and I found that hard.
So sad.
Somebody who should have had a really big, large...
Raucous
send-off of, like, this huge family.
Colour and people and love. And
God, like, wow, you know... And it was just a very small thing. And it's, yeah, I mean, I had a Zoom funeral experience, which was so strange, and
so discombobulating.
Yeah,
so distant and yet so intense.
It was, and it's funny, like we said, this thing about technology. So it was, I'll say her name because it was a wonderful, wonderful woman who was a palliative care nurse called Kimberly St. John, who worked at Guy's and St. Thomas's, who was doing incredible work in advanced care planning and was just a leading light in her field.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
And so I couldn't be at the funeral because at that point my daughter had corona symptoms. She was fine, but obviously you don't want to go to a funeral and cause more trouble.
Spread it.
So it was really interesting because I was so glad that Zoom existed, that I could go, that I could see, that I could hear the stories. But not being able to have the ritual of being with them, it was so strange. The hugs. And oh, you know, I watched it in my bedroom, and then I had to come out and immediately deal with, like, an argument because Hey Dougie was being turned off and CB, you know, like, it was like, oh. And you suddenly realise the rituals of going to a place, whether it is a religious place or it's just a place, and then being with those people, and the ritual of coming back to your house. I think we've all suddenly really appreciated how important commutes are, journeys, what they do to us to heal something. So I found it...
Boundaries. You know, boundaries, that you step out of your bedroom.
Yeah.
You step out of your role as a parent. You step into your role as a friend and a mourner. You take the journey to the place. You walk into the place. You allow yourself to embrace and feel embodied the connection to everybody else who cares about this person. and you've never met most of them before, but you all have a common sense of connectedness because yeah. you're there to celebrate their life, to mourn their death, and that that holds you, and you cry and you hug and you laugh at the stories, and then you step out
yeah.
and you transition away from the memorial hall or whatever it is, the crematorium, to home, and then you step in. And this lack of transition that we have yeah. and the lack of boundaries, and how do we hold them in our relationship where you're a mum, you're a partner, you're a performer, you're a podcaster, you're a writer, you're a daughter, you're a messed up human being.
You're having a breakdown, yeah. this is too much. Yeah.
All in the same room, in the same moment, is kind of crazy making.
Yeah.
We need our separate spaces. The last time you and I did this, I walked to your studio. It was really nice. And I thought about that today. I thought I could have had a really nice walk, had a little coffee on the way. Mm. I could have stepped in. I could have given you a hug. We could have sat down together. And it is lovely that we can do this.
Yes.
And that I can
yes.
see you. I'm not denying that. But there's the physical contact is huge.
Mm.
And the transition, the movement between.
Yeah, and I suppose maybe it's worth just acknowledging that, isn't it? That I agree, like, if it wasn't for Zoom and the internet, I wouldn't be able to be releasing a new series right now. So great, that's amazing. And I've been able to speak yeah. to people in America because suddenly it's like, oh, I can talk to you. It's all available to me. But it doesn't stop. It's not like, oh, let's permanently do this. Like, we need connections. We need relationships.
We need to step out, to step back.
Yeah. Oh, Julia, I mean, God, thank you so much as ever. So interesting, covering so many topics. And the book is out. It came out in lockdown, but it's still available. This Too Shall Pass, Stories of Change, Crisis and Hopeful Beginnings. And if people haven't
read it. Quite a good title right now, do
yeah,
you?
Yeah, oh my God, yes. I feel like I need that tattooed on my my body somewhere. This Will Pass. And the book, obviously your first book, Grief Works, is still available to buy. If people haven't read that, I'd hugely recommend it if you're beginning your journey of grief. It's one of our most commonest recommended books on
good.
The Twitter and Instagram, and with each other, people are always like, oh yeah, like that's number one, like just read that one.
Thank you.
And then here's some
thank
others
you.
But like, oh, just read the textbook first.
Thank you.
And then you can read the others. And I think I'll just try and remember what you said of like, we have to build some hope in this situation that we're all currently facing.
Choose to build it.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. It's our choice.
Yeah.
Well, Julia, thank you so much, really appreciate
lovely
it
lovely seeing you.
You can follow Julia on Instagram at Julia Samuel, MBE. Her book, Grief Work, and This Too Shall Pass are out now. I cannot recommend them enough. Especially if you are in the club. Grief Works is her introduction to just what grief is was one of the most clearest, insightful paragraphs I've read about it. So yeah, stamp of approval from Griefcast. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show, as ever, was edited by Kate Holland, and the music was provided by The Glue Ensemble, artwork by Jade Perkin. I've been Carrie Lloyd. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.